My castaway this week is a photographer. She was born in Philadelphia more than 70 years ago, the daughter of immigrant Russian Jews. Her passion for photography began in her teens with the present of a camera and has continued throughout her long and adventurous life. Marilyn Monroe, Joan Crawford, Paul Newman and many other stars have fallen under the spell of her lens. She's also travelled the world in search of arresting pictures, living with hippie communes or the Black Power movement. Today she's regarded as one of the world's outstanding photojournalists, defining the secret of her skill as showing you something you wouldn't have seen if the photographer hadn't shown it to you. She is Eve Arnold. Can you flesh out that definition, Eve? Is the skill showing you something you couldn't see with the naked eye, or is it directing the eye towards something?
No, it is a point of view. It's focusing in closely on something that appeals or repels. It's like writing a lead sentence. It does that kind of thing.
It says, stop here, look at this.
And look at this. And it says, this is the way I see it.
But do you, when you see something, do you see it with a photographer's eye? Well, of course you do, but do you suddenly look at it and think, I know how I could make that look through the lens?
Well, what the photographer tries to do is to give meaning to whatever it is he's seeing, and is trying to communicate that meaning beyond his own vision to the person who is viewing that picture.
But obviously you have different ways of doing that, and you have different styles of photography. I'm thinking, first of all, of a Sunday Times magazine cover of a violinist that you did for a music festival way back now, where the girl violinist is almost she's a silhouette, almost a shadow, isn't she? And yet her instrument is terribly clear. Would you see the girl violinist and think, with a trick of light here, I can create this clever image?
I did not introduce the light. The light was there.
Natural, available
light, we call it. That is the difference between a studio photographer and a photojournalist. In the very beginning, I learned how to light in a studio and then gave all that up because film is very fast. Light is there for you. If you want the reality and not imposing your own ideas, then you use the light that is out there.
Mm. But then there are other pictures that you've done, and one of the most memorable, I think, is Marilyn Monroe in the Ladies' Loo, looking at her hair in the mirror, and you're behind her, the camera's behind her, as it were, and her skirt is hitched up, and you can just see the back of her knickers. I mean, that presumably was not something you thought about, or you suddenly took it on the hoof.
Well, you're there to observe, and your reflexes have to be very, very fast. And then when you see something, then it catches you and you catch it.
But then another style again, I'm thinking of a photograph you took of Alec Douglas-Hume when he was Prime Minister at home in Scotland, sitting in his chair. His wife is standing at the fireplace. They look as if there's nobody else in the room, let alone a camera. Now, how do you achieve that?
When I went to Scotland to photograph Alec Douglas-Hume, who was then Prime Minister, he was wonderful. When the car stopped outside this great house of his, he came out and carried my camera bag in. So instantly there was a kind of rapport between us. And it obtained for the rest of the day when I worked with him and with his wife. I had lunch with him. I was invited in to see the house and to move about and to pick whatever location I wanted. And that picture was at the end of the day. I think they were tired. I think they'd had enough of me. And they were just in my hands.
Tell me about your first record.
My first record is Marilyn Monroe. Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. I had gotten to know her and photographed her over a 10-year stretch. And she was quite extraordinary, and this song reminds me of her. And I think music is very much about memory for me. And nature bestows that great gift of memory when you age. And so many of my records that I've chosen are about what these things meant to me in very personal terms.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end.
Marilyn Monroe and Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. As you say, Eve Arnold, you worked with her, knew her on and off over a period of 10 years until the year before she died in 62. How special was she in your view? Do you think she deserved to be the legend she now is?
I think she was extraordinary. She had created that figure out of whole cloth, and so she was an original. She embodied so much vulnerability, so much weakness, so much strength. And she seemed a symbol for so much of what was going on in the 50s and 60s that still obtains and carries forward.
But was she physically confident? I mean, we know she obviously wasn't emotionally, but in front of the camera and so on, she loved it. She knit love.
She adored the still camera more than the motion picture camera, because with a still camera, she was in charge. She could be late and it didn't matter. There wasn't a crew waiting for her. She didn't have to learn any lines. She photographed 10 pounds lighter, which was surprising.
That's unusual, isn't it? I mean,
it's most unusual. Most people photograph 10 pounds heavier. The other thing that she had that nobody's ever remarked on, that I don't know why, she had sort of a film of hair. The light would glow on her face.
A sort of down.
A down, yes. Sort of like a baby's down when a child is born. You get that very soft look on a child's face. That's what she maintained.
The sort of trick people try to achieve with Vaseline around the lens. It is
right.
Softness
the glow.
Around the edge.
The glow.
But she could just switch it on, couldn't she?
Absolutely. She would say to me, "Let's make a Marilyn." We'd walk down the street and she would look a mess. Hair wasn't combed. She had on a sloppy sweater. And suddenly she would sort of rise up. She was small. She was about 5'4". And she would become Marilyn Monroe. And you would get into a cab with her, and the cab driver would say, "Lady, if you combed your hair, put on a little makeup, changed your clothes, you'd look like Marilyn Monroe." And she'd laugh.
And then she'd speak, and they knew it was her.
Yes. The speech was interesting, because she had stuttered as a child. And so that breathless quality was trying to get control of the voice.
Did you sense, though, her deep unhappiness? And did you have any hint?
In a little bit. I remember when I came out for the last film, for The Misfits, and I had not seen her in about 4 years. She said to me, "How do I look?" And I said, "You look wonderful." She did. And she said, "Oh, I don't know." She said, "I'm 34 years old. I'm tired. I've been dancing for 6 months on a film called Let's Make Love." And she said, "Where do I go from here?" And it was really very touching. She was not talking to me. She was talking to herself about what a trying time she was having. Her marriage to Miller had just broken up. She was desperately sad.
Record number two.
My choice of Paul Robeson singing Schlaf mein Kind is very important to me because he sings a lullaby in Yiddish. My mother used to sing it in Russian, and it's called Sleep My Child. And it's a very tender lullaby, and my mother sang it to me as a child.
Schlaf mein Kind, schlaf geseder, singen will ich dir ein Lied, als du mein Kind wirst älter werden, wirst du.
Paul Robeson and Schlaf mein Kind. Your photography is self-taught, isn't it, Eve? You never really had any professional training.
Oh, I had 6 weeks of training at the New School for Social Research under Brodovich, who was the great hero of magazine art direction.
This was in New York?
In New York.
Just 6 weeks?
6 weeks. It was given at a school called New School for Social Research.
How did you get on?
Well, the first day that I went to the class, I brought some pictures with me. Brodovich had told the class that we were all going to criticize each other's work. And the class was just savage with me. My work was not very good. It was very much camera club kind of thing. And I left that class determined that I would never go back. However, I was too intrigued with what the assignment that was given us was, which was for the following week we were all to go out and photograph a fashion shot. And I wasn't interested in fashion, but I dug up a group of fashion models in Harlem. And it was really quite incredible because this was in the 50s when you couldn't place a magazine article in a white magazine about a black. But I was intrigued with these young women. It was before the civil rights movement became very heavy in the States. And these women in Harlem were sewing their own clothes, designing them. It was at once an attempt to go their own way and also an attempt to turn their backs on 7th Avenue and the rag trade in New York. And I photographed there, came back with the pictures to the class of one of the models called Fabulous. Her name was Charlotte Stribling, but she called herself Fabulous. And Brodovich, who was giving the class, decided that these were fine pictures and I was to go back and continue photographing, and I went back for over a year.
But why, what was so extraordinary about them?
Well, these were the days when people worked mainly in studios and everything was beautifully lit and retouched and organized. And these were simply documentation and recordings of what was going on.
It was kind of reportage.
A reportage with no additional light. Everything as was.
And the models moving, not posed?
No, the models moving and, you know, preparing and putting on their makeup and their wigs and doing whatever they were doing.
But was it so very different in terms of the image? I mean, I've seen the pictures you're talking about, and Fabulous was kind of sashaying towards you, wasn't she, with these wonderful clothes on?
Well, she was in motion.
Yeah.
And that was not what happened. You would always say, hold it. If you were in a studio and photographing a model, it was always posy. It was always contrived. Whereas this was natural. And because I didn't know it shouldn't be done that way, I did it my way.
So it was available light. It was, well, you were off the tripod. It was handheld. Was
handheld.
It? Which was incredibly avant-garde, really, wasn't it?
You were, yes, but it's now gone into the visual language, that kind of thing.
But those pictures, I think, found their way to Picture Post, didn't they?
Yes.
And you got, I think it's an 8-page spread and a cover.
And a cover, yeah.
as a sort of practically an amateur, you must have been thrilled a bit.
I was delighted, of course.
How did it happen? How did they get there?
My ex-husband had gone to school in Britain, and he knew of Picture Post, and he knew that I would be heartbroken because no American magazine would publish those pictures, and he sent them off.
They wouldn't publish them because the models were black?
Because the models were black and because they were so different from everything else that was happening. They would be considered, you know, what is this? Why are we doing this? When we can light her up, why are we doing it this way?
So Picture Post grabbed them. And not only that, they were then syndicated across Europe, weren't they?
Yes. A German agent wrote and said they belonged to her, and she syndicated them without telling me.
So you didn't make too much money out of it?
No.
But they were sold across the world, and you were, I think, as a result of that, invited to become the first American woman member of Magnum, the elite international cooperative of photographers, which I want to ask you about in a moment, but let's pause there for record number 3.
In my Desert Island Discs, I wanted very badly to have the magic flute. The voice of the flute is very beautiful.
Part of the overture to Mozart's Magic Flute, played by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. By the way, Eve, who was it who gave you that first camera when you were 17 or 18, I think you were given it?
It was a boyfriend who was a camera club nut. He gave me my first camera, and I was going to school at night, and weekends we would get together, he and I, and we would photograph things we'd seen in the camera magazines.
What kind of camera was it? Do you remember?
It was a Rolleicord, and it cost $40. Took 12 images.
So it was quite a generous present.
Oh, in those days, yes.
Absolutely. Because you had not been well off as a child, had you? You were one of nine children born
right.
before the Depression. So, I mean, being given a camera by a boyfriend was a major event, I would think.
Yes, it was a great delight. And I felt very happy about it. I was going to be a doctor. That was my plan. And the moment I got the camera, I was hooked.
So in 1952, following the success of those Harlem shots, with the fashion shots we were talking about, you were invited to join Magnum, as I said. How big was it then? Who ran it? What was it?
It was a very lively group of nonconformists. It had been founded by four men who had been in the Second World War. Robert Coppa, who was a journalist during the war, worked for Life magazine. And there was Cartier-Bresson, George Roger, and David Seymour. And the contribution that Magnum has made, I think, to photography is the ownership of the negative.
The ownership of the copyright.
Right.
Because, therefore, presumably, even now, when Marilyn Monroe's pictures are published, or whoever else you've ever photographed, you still get paid, do you?
Yes, of course.
Yes. Can you tell me how that can be justified? Because, after all, what's selling the picture really is the person in front of the lens, not the person behind it. It's the
yes,
image, the performer.
Would it exist without the person behind the lens? If you write about somebody, you own copyright. Why shouldn't the image have the same validity and same worth as the word?
But it's difficult to believe that, for example, someone today like Madonna, shall we say, would hand over that copyright. Surely these days,
no,
the big stars...
These days, people like Madonna have the right to destroy a negative if they so choose. Some actors and personalities insist upon being paid in perpetuity for the use of their faces and their bodies. And I understand that. I'm sympathetic to it.
But going back to you and Magnum in 1952, that must have been an incredible experience because you were very inexperienced, really. When
absolutely.
You were a wife and a mother by that
right.
stage, so you're obviously quite driven to photography. But suddenly to be rubbing shoulders with these great names must have been an incredible experience.
It was wonderful because we would show each other pictures. We would talk about the photographs. We would join together and go and look at exhibitions. We would do all of that. We don't do that very much now.
What was the best piece of advice you were ever given by those people, those photographers?
I guess it was Coppa who, and he said this to many people, but he also said it to me, if you're not good enough, it's because you're not close enough. The idea being that to get at the essence of it, you must get close, whether it's physically or emotionally.
More music. This is number four.
Oh, Bessie Smith. I grew up with jazz, and I loved the Bessie Smith recordings. And one of my favorites was Alexander's Ragtime Band. And then it became alive for me when I started working in Harlem. And I went back many, many times through the 60s during the period when there was great civil strife in the States. And whenever I'm in New York, if I think it's safe, I'd go to Harlem.
Oh, honey, lamps, I'm all alone. I'm all alone. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man, up to the man, who is the leader of the band. And if you hear the yell of the Suwannee River, playing in ragtime, come on in here, come on in here. Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Bessie Smith and Alexander's Ragtime Band. You're still only one of four members of Magnum, Eve Arnold, so you're a rare bird. Do you think, however, there are advantages to being a woman photographer?
You have enormous advantages. Women feel very good being photographed by other women. Men enjoy it. And I found it was one of the great pluses.
That women trust you, and specifically, of course, Joan Crawford trusted you, didn't she? She swore, quote, love and eternal trust always, and with good reason, I think.
Well, the story I did on Joan Crawford is an extraordinary one. We have pictures of her lying across a table with a massage at the head, a massage at the feet, a poodle in the crotch, The face strapped up in bandages because she's having a facial. It was beyond what I would have asked for.
She wanted it.
She wanted to, her public, as she said, to know what it was like to hang on to that mountain, the mountain being Hollywood, for 30 years.
But there was one particular instance, wasn't there, when you saved Joan Crawford from herself?
The first time I met her, she was very anxious that I photograph her in the nude. We had gone to a dress designer called Tina Lesser, and Joan was to try on some clothes with her daughter, Christina. Christina was not there when I arrived. Joan and I went into a dressing room. She stripped, and she said, "I'm ready." And something happens to flesh after 50, and I decided that it was not a good idea. She insisted. I said, "Can't we wait for Christina?" "No, we can't. I'm ready." And so I picked up the camera. I was so nervous that I didn't realize that I had color in the camera. I'd never developed a roll of color in my life. And I didn't dare take it back to a processor because I was afraid that he might then proceed to take a few prints off for himself, and I couldn't let that happen. I kept saying no, 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 but at any rate, I did them. And then
I gave them back to her.
Yes, she drank all the time.
So what happened to the negs?
I gave them back to her. And that's when she said, "Love and eternal trust always."
But I don't want to give the impression that your career was all Hollywood during those years, because far from it. Let me go to the other extreme. You photographed at one point Senator Joe McCarthy, didn't you, during his witch hunt for American communists. Presumably you didn't set out to protect him from himself.
No, he was a hateful man, and he held America to ransom. He was really a horror. He was a very wily man and very hard to dislike because he had a kind of oily charm that he turned on. And when I came into the hearing room at the Senate, he stopped what he was doing, came down off the dais where he was holding forth, came to me to this one freelance photographer. He was so avid. He wanted every possible picture, every possible word about him. He came over to me to find out where I worked and for whom and what I wanted to do. And when I told him that I worked for Fortune and for Life, and by this time I was, he then let me do whatever I wanted. And they finished the hearing one morning, and he came over to me and put his arm up on my shoulder. And suddenly I realized this man that I thought was so loathsome, he was there with his hand on my shoulder. So I put my hand up to put his away, and I suddenly realized it wasn't a smart thing to do, so I wound up holding hands with him. And I turned around and looked at these 30 press people that were standing there staring at me, and it was just awful. So I simply said, "Excuse me, Senator, I have to go to work." So he removed his hand. I went to work. When I went down into the Senate dining room, none of the men sitting at the tables, the press table, would talk to me.
Quite frightening, actually.
It was terrifying.
More music.
The Monteverdi Vespers. This is for my son. You know, I wanted to be a doctor before I became a photographer. My son is now a doctor. And one of the images I have of him is of him listening to the Monteverdi Vespers.
The opening of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, and the Early Music Consort of London, conducted by Philip Ledger. If you were afraid, Eve, when American newsmen ostracised you, you must have been terrified when Life magazine assigned you to Malcolm X, the black Muslim leader, for 18 months. How threatening an experience was that?
It was scary because the women would glare at me at the various black Muslim meetings. The head of the American Nazi Party showed up with some Nazis because he and Malcolm were playing games together. The idea was that America would be split in two, that the Muslims would get the eastern seaboard and everything in between, and the Nazis would get the west coast and everything going toward the middle. George Lincoln Rockwell, who was head of the American Nazi Party, said to me, "I'm going to make a lampshade out of you." And I said, as long as it's not a bar of soap, and kept on shooting. That was frightening. And then at one point, when I'd gotten to know Malcolm quite well, he took me to an outdoor meeting in Harlem. There was one crazed woman in particular who was running around yelling, "Kill the white bitch, kill the white bitch." But I kept on shooting, walked around the crowd. And it was a summer's night, and I still remember I had on a linen dress and a woolen sweater. When I got back to the Life office to have the film processed, I took my sweater off and unzipped the pockets in which I had my film, looked at the back of the sweater. It was polka-dotted with cigarette burns because wool doesn't burn, it smolders. And as I'd gone around the crowd, they'd been sticking lighted cigarettes into the back of me.
But you've been moving so fast.
We've been moving very fast.
It would be easy to conclude, therefore, that Eve Arnold has been incredibly brave in her career. I wonder if you feel that, or whether you... Perhaps you don't even feel fear at the time because you're doing a job.
It never occurs to me to be afraid. And then I'm a case of delayed reaction. After it's over, I get the shakes.
Yeah.
But not in the beginning. I think the thing that motivated me was curiosity. And even the fear was part of that curiosity, part of seeing how I would react to different stimuli.
But the sacrifices are huge, aren't they? The sacrifices
are... No, they're enormous.
Well, family, certainly. You're just not at home.
You're not there. And that, I think, is the most painful. I was always cry when I got into a plane to go away. But it never occurred to me to stay home.
Record number six.
Record number six is the Vivaldi Flute Concerto. Particularly because it reminds me of something that happened early on. I had a house in Long Island, and in the summers, we would sit out of doors, and there was a great trellis of roses, and we would play Vivaldi Concerti, and birds, starlings, would come and settle on the rose bush. And then we tried stopping that recording, put some jazz on, the birds would fly away, we'd put the Vivaldi back, and the birds would come back.
Of Vivaldi's Flute Concerto No. 1 in D major, played by Gastone Tisinari with I Musici Virtuosi di Milano. You and your family, Eve, moved to London in the early 60s when the Sunday Times colour magazine, colour supplement, had just started, and you went to work on it with all those names, Snowden, Bailey, Donovan, McCullin. Can you recall the atmosphere of it? It must be very exciting.
It was an adventure playground. It was really quite wonderful. We had almost total control of what we wanted to be. You know, I would call up and say, I thought it'd be nice to do something on veiled women. And Michael Rand, who was the art director and quite wonderful, would then say, where do you want to go? And I wound up in that case in the Arab Emirates, in Egypt, and Afghanistan.
So you had a kind of editorial freedom of your own, really?
Absolutely.
You know, there wasn't a picture editor sitting behind a desk in London telling you what your picture ought to be.
It was so open. Sunday Times applied for 15 years for a visa for me to go to China. And because I was an American, the Americans were at odds with the Chinese, I couldn't get the visa. When it finally came through, immediately after diplomatic relations were resumed between America and China, I called Michael Rand and said, look, my visa's come through. And he said, then we better have a Chinese lunch and talk about it. When I said to him over that Chinese lunch, how do you see this? Any words of wisdom in a hurry, I said to him. And he said, well, if you're in Peking, you might do a story on Peking duck.
So basically it was down to you.
Yes.
But that's obviously what you've enjoyed, flying by the seat of your pants, actually. You haven't wanted a safe life, have you?
No, and I don't regret that I didn't have one. But I've often wondered what it would be like.
Record number 7.
Jimi Hendrix and Little Wing. This is for Michael, my grandson, who's 18, and who has lots of hair, just like Jimi Hendrix, and who plays Little Wing a lot of the time.
With a thousand smiles, she gives to me free. It's all right, she said, it's all right. Anything you want from me.
Jimi Hendrix and Little Wing, and memories of your grandson, whom you've taught photography. Can you do that? Is it possible to teach photography?
No, you can teach them technique, but you can't teach them photography. The thing is to learn enough technique, then forget about it, and go out and do what you can.
And then learn to see, presumably.
Yes,
as
yes.
You say, if you walk around seeing things in a certain way.
But you have to look before you see. When you've looked long enough, then there is sight, there is understanding.
And has your grandson taken one of those very rare pictures, that is of you? Because you're like so many photographers, you don't like having your own photograph taken, do you?
No, I don't. I don't like the way I look on photographs.
Do any of us?
But yes, we do. The thing that I have found, that a photograph, I took a photograph of you today, let's say a passport photograph, and you look at it and you take it out of the booth and you say, oh, my God. 5 years later, when you go back for the new one, you look at the old one and you say, well, it's not so bad.
Your job's inevitably meant, as we've discussed, that you've been a bit of a gypsy, so I presume that a desert island will be just another place, maybe another job to you, would it?
Oh, no, because I would be alone, which is nice. I enjoy solitude, time to think and reflect. No, for a short time. I think I'd like that.
Last record.
The last record is one by John Williams, who's a good friend, and I would like friends around me on the island, and he's a remarkable guitarist, so it's something I would like to hear again and again.
Part of the prelude to Bach's Lute Suite No. 4 in E major, played by John Williams. So if you could only take one of those records, not all 80, which one would it be?
I would think the Vivaldi.
See if the birds would come and sit alongside. What about your book?
I think this is an obvious one, 1001 Nights. Also because I've worked in the Middle East, because it's always interested me, because I've made a film about harems in Arabia, And I thought every night I could turn it on, we'd listen to one tale, and I could go on for 3 years like that.
And what about your luxury?
Could I have a dark room with some film and camera?
I'm sure you could.
Okay, then that's it.
Eve Arnold, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.